Today's guest says sometimes you must look back just one last time in order to move forward. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am pleased to introduce today's guest, Jody Prowse, who is the author of The Sun Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, and Addiction, and How I Broke Free. Jody, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks for having me. I'm really grateful to be here.
Now, Jody, your bio attaches many titles to you. A daughter, a sister, a wife, a mother, an aunt, a friend, a neighbor, a coworker, an advocate. Many of those hats, though, came with many tears, and some now, perhaps, with great joy. What do you say?
I say that's very true. And, you know, I always like introducing myself like that because I don't think that's different than any other female out there in the world trying to maneuver through life. We are so many different things to so many different people, aren't we?
Indeed. And we do, in fact, wear lots of different hats.
Yeah, we do.
And I think many women, which of course is probably a whole other conversation, but many women don't think about themselves as wearing so many different hats.
No, I don't think you realize it. And certainly with my story, I thought I had a handle on everything that was going on until I came crashing down also. And really understanding, and again, I think as women that it's inbred in most of us that we look after other people. And sometimes we do that with the detriment of what's best for us individually.
You begin The Sun Is Gone with what I thought was a really interesting, stunning observation. You say, and I quote, "I have known what the word alcoholic means since I was 5 years old." That is such a stunning, sad concept.
You know, I think even now, you know, I'm almost 49 years old, and I see people in families, and I hear them talk, and all these secrets that are going on behind closed doors, and especially when, you know, addiction and mental illness runs in our family. And I think that parents and adults, I think they're very naive in thinking that they're keeping these secrets. They're not. The little children are observing and they're listening, and all that's happening by you not sitting down and talking to them, it's just allowing our little minds of 4, 5, 6 years old to try and figure this out on our own. And sometimes we don't take the right lessons out of that. So that's very much one of my messages, is talking to children, because, you know, I was that little girl. And yes, as much as they tried to hide all this alcoholism in my family, I was very much aware.
And, you know, the truth is that there are adults well into their adulthood who can't figure out the things under which secrets can be hidden. And so to imagine that a child or children would be able to figure it out in a healthy way, just if you think about it from that perspective, of course you want to talk to your children. And of course you want to answer their questions.
Yeah, and I think you don't realize. And I do want to make one thing so clear. No one is doing any of this on purpose. You know, I grew up with a father that drank too much. My uncle was a severe alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic and suffered with mental health issues. This is an illness, and no one is hurting and doing damage on purpose, but that damage is done sometimes. And, you know, to use as an example, my brother and I, and it wasn't until much, much later in adulthood that I really understood the impact that that had on us. My brother would also become another alcoholic in our family tree.
You also speak early on in The Sun Is Gone about the fact that your parents, they didn't beat you and your brother, but you said the scars remained. For him, would you say one of the scars was the alcoholism?
Oh, my gosh, most definitely. You know, I hear so many times, why does one child become an alcoholic? Why does somebody else not? And, you know, we have to understand, we're all unique individuals. We're all, of course, I'm older. I'm able to comprehend what's going on a little bit more. And I think very much with my brother, and I didn't understand this until really just a couple of years ago, is we know so much more now about addiction and mental illness that it can be caused by childhood trauma and or sexual abuse. And these things that we see can cause anxiety, depression, more severe mental health issues, and alcohol and drug addiction later in life. And I think if we had known that, and it goes back to if our family had talked about it, my brother could have got more help that he needed. You know, instead of just people always saying, just stop drinking, instead of getting to the bottom of why he was drinking.
Exactly. And certainly you and your brother clung to each other. There was a lot of chaos that would happen episodically in your household, and the two of you were a real buffer for each other. And it seems like you really took on the role of parenting your brother, almost protecting your brother.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about the lessons that, you know, we had violent fighting from our parents, and seeing my father intoxicated, and, you know, the arguments, or having to flee the house in the middle of the night. I just talked about how I think it affected my brother in his later years, but it affected me in a different way. For my whole life, I didn't want my life to turn out that way. Everything bad to me seemed to happen from alcohol. And so I went and the complete opposite end of the scale. And yeah, my brother Brett and I were best friends. You know, I didn't understand it as much then, just our deep love for each other came from. And I think we felt safe when we were together. And he very much did depend on me. And so I think that's one of the hardest things I've had to live with, because as I thought he was dying from alcoholism, I just was obsessed with saving him. I felt it was my job, and I was failing.
And now, I mean, as you talk about it, I know you know that it was not your job, but so many people are in that place where they try to take on responsibility for the behavior of someone else.
Oh, and you know, and I understand that so well, because your heart is in the right place. The person you love, you know, for me it was my brother, but it could be your spouse, it could be your daughter, it could be your parent. And just the thought of them, every minute of every day is consumed with the thought that they're going to die. And that really does cloud your judgment as to doing what's actually best for yourself and best for them.
Absolutely.
And I was trapped in that for a very, very long time. And I'm still a work in progress, having to, you know, breaking those patterns of looking after my family members. You know, I'd been doing it for almost 40 years. And so it's very hard to finally find the courage to say no.
To set those healthy limits that really we all need to be able to set in order to survive well. You mentioned a moment ago the fights between your mom and dad, and you as a child, your mom, your brother, you having to flee the household only to return. And you talk about the day when you were 9 as being a day that you felt, you said to yourself, that it was the best day of your life. You were 9 years old. What happened that day?
Oh, and I still, 40 years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And we came home. We had to go stay in a, you know, seedy hotel because we didn't have any money. And we came home in the morning. And, you know, usually my dad was lying on the couch hungover, and he wasn't there that day. And I walked up into the kitchen, and I saw a note in his little squiggle handwriting, and his wedding ring was sitting on top. And I don't write and talk about this in my book out of any disrespect for my father, but I wanted just to show the world how a child feels. And I remember standing there thinking, you know, my daddy's never coming back. And it was the happiest day of my life.
And that is just, I mean, it almost sends chills just to imagine that little 9-year-old girl. And that's the joy. That's the reason for the joy.
Yeah. And doesn't mean that she doesn't love her daddy and all those things. But I didn't want the chaos. I wanted peace in our family, and I wanted happiness. And even at that young age, I did have the consciousness to know that we deserved that.
After your dad left, did life become more calm for your household?
Oh, my gosh. My mother married the most remarkable man, our stepfather, Ron, who raised us. It couldn't have been more loving and stable and peaceful and calm and just normal. Average. They never drank more than, you know, the occasional cocktail that people do. And so it was a beautiful, beautiful childhood. And, you know, it wasn't until later in life, you know, my brother's early 20s, that I started seeing signs that I think he's in trouble with alcohol.
You talk about, though, for yourself at 14, you were in the ninth grade, and you were sneaking out of the house. Unfortunately for the parents who are listening, 14-year-olds do that very often. What were you doing at 14 when you were sneaking out of the house? Where'd you go?
I know, because, you know, people look at me now, and I said I always did have this strict boundary for myself of, you know, I didn't want my life to turn out that way. And yes, although we did have a wonderful childhood, I think my own mom was never that attentive as to what, you know, the problems we were getting into, and didn't really look into that. I was sneaking out of my house in the middle of the night. I was skipping school. I was drinking and getting into the bar at 14. And I was dabbling in, you know, marijuana at that time, and, you know, getting high and being a rebellious teenager. But for myself, when I became in my early 20s, I just, you know, I eventually got married, and I thought, okay, that part of my life is over. But there's a difference between myself and my brother and so many other people. My brother became addicted to alcohol, and he couldn't stop. I never became addicted. And so for me, it was just simply, okay, I'm growing up, and I'm not going to do that anymore.
There came a time early on in your marriage when your mother called you and asked you for help with your younger sister, Nicole. Once again, you were being challenged to be the caretaker for a sibling. What was going on then?
Yeah, you know, I was 21 years old. I had just gotten married. I had a new baby, and my mother ended up getting a divorce from my stepdad after all of us children kind of grew up. And Nicole was still at home. She was only 15 at the time, but she was struggling, I think, with the divorce. I mean, that was, you know, although we always saw our dad on, you know, some weekends, Ron really was our father figure. And so, understandably, Nicole was struggling, and my mom just couldn't handle it and asked me to live with her. And so here I am, this young newlywed in her early 20s, and having to go to the school and getting phoned by the police and just all these things of it, my sister just being out of control. And, you know, it caused stress in my marriage. And what I really think it did, though, she lived with us for a year before I said, I can't do this. And I think it changed our sister-sister dynamic forever. We have never been close since then. And you're absolutely right. I think I was always put in the caretaker role. And my own mom, once again, she didn't do it on purpose. She doesn't even see that she did it. So these are the things that I've had to come to terms with.
I can't imagine the impact on your marriage. I mean, you are at that age, you're kind of still a baby yourself, and you've had a baby and you're young in your marriage, and then you're, so now you have two children, but one's a sibling.
Yeah, and all of a sudden I'm 21 and trying to look after a 15-year-old. Like, no, you're so right. And I think, you know, proudly I'm going to tell you, I've been married to my husband for 27 years.
Congratulations.
I made many mistakes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I made so many mistakes on this journey. And for 20 of those years, I sadly put my mom, my sister, and my brother ahead of my own children as well as my own husband. I very much was trapped in the patterns that had been put on me since I was a 5 or 6 year old girl.
What was your husband's reaction as a newlywed when he discovered that you were going to take on the responsibility for his sister-in-law, a 15-year-old?
If I'm being really honest, I don't think, like now we, you know, with all this that's happened and the therapy and all those things, we communicate so much more now. And we have for probably, you know, for years and years. But back then, you're so young, you don't realize you're doing it. You know, it isn't my husband just kept saying, it isn't that at 22 my husband ever would have said, Jody, this isn't your responsibility. And he just accepted it is the way that it was. And I think that shows a lot about young people, right? And we don't have all the answers. And or anybody, and why therapy is so important, because they help you figure all that out. I don't think you see it. You love your family. You'll do anything for them.
The notion, and I know this is important for you to underscore with the listeners and the readers of The Sun Is Gone, limits are a healthy endeavor. And they're healthy not only for you as the family member, but also for the individual who was really challenged by the addiction. And, you know, it's real easy not to see that, to actually think that setting limits is cruel and selfish. And it's not at all.
Oh, and I hear that. You know, I had to, for 6 years, I neglected everything, my job. You know, so my career, my health, my own health, my children, my husband, just obsessed for 6 years with saving the brother that I loved so very, very much. And, you know, finally I did what was right, and I set a healthy boundary. It didn't mean I wasn't there to help him, but a healthy boundary in a healthy way. And I worked hard with a therapist to figure out what that was. But people make you feel like you're abandoning them.
Yes.
And that is not what you are doing. And so you don't buy into anybody that makes you feel that way. You know, I just saying no to somebody can be just the most kindest, compassionate, most wonderful thing you can do.
And again, not something that a lot of folks understand. Is much healthier than becoming the go-to person for the person who's dealing with an addiction. There was a time when your brother took you to a meeting and he said something and you cried. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to tell us about that meeting and that moment. Jody, the meeting that your brother took you to, what was that meeting?
Well, he was, I think at the time, 20 or 21 years old, and he stopped by my house, and he said, "I have a favor to ask you." And, you know, we're best friends, so he had asked favors all the time, and so he wanted me to go somewhere with him, and, you know, we're driving, and I'm kind of anxious and excited, like, you know, what's the surprise? And we drove about 10 or 15 minutes, and we pulled into this building, and when we got there, there was a bunch of people kind of, I could tell they knew each other, and they were visiting, and I still can't believe I didn't even figure out where we were, but we started all sitting down, and one by one, everybody said their name, and then they got to my brother, and he said, "Hi, my name is Brett, and I'm an alcoholic," and I just was the stranger, just hysterical, gasping for breath, crying so hard as my worst fear was coming true. And I had no idea he had a drinking problem. I mean, he drank no different than anyone, any other child, let's say, that's 20 or 21. And but sadly, I'm going to say after that AA meeting, it was, he never mentioned it again for probably 6 or 7 years until I acknowledged I thought something was seriously wrong.
He was silent about it for 6 or 7 years?
Yeah. Until I think he was 20. So 6 or 7 years, I never heard him mention it again. I think now in hindsight I look, and that was his early acknowledgement maybe. Maybe it was affecting his relationship with his girlfriend at the time. I don't know. Again, we were so young, we didn't talk in detail about it. And it's a regret I have. I would talk so in detail about why he thought he had a problem and what was going on. But I didn't. I didn't know all of this then. And I certainly didn't think my brother's life was going to go downhill, you know, and be destroyed. And he kept drinking occasionally. And then, like I said, 6 or 7 years later, I knew he was in trouble. He was drinking a lot.
Now, during those 6 or 7 years, you had a child when your sister came, but then you had another child, yes?
Yeah, I did, and so I had little Ryan, and when I finally, you know, saw my brother's in trouble, of course, there's my instinct to phone and tell him what I think, invite him to come and move in with us, and so that's what he ended up doing. He didn't acknowledge he thought he had a problem, but I knew deep in my soul that he was in trouble.
How did you know?
I just saw it. There wasn't some big blazing sign, and so I don't want anyone, because this can happen to a young teenager.
Right.
And I don't want people to think there's a blazing sign that's, okay, your brother's going to die, or all these things. It was really little personality changes. He wasn't coming around very often to see me. He was missing some of our family occasions and that of my sons. He would never have done that. He was drinking and driving and, you know, making some, you know, choices that I didn't think he would have made before. He was spending much more time with our biological father, who, again, drinks. And I knew drinking was always involved whenever they did things. Just those things, just they worried me. And as it turns out, sadly, I was correct.
As your brother, during that span of time, again, your life is going on. You've had a child. You have two children. Yeah. You're married. You're still in the early stages of your marriage in a lot of ways. How did your worry and your attention to your brother impact you and your family?
Oh, it's, I, I, I neglected them. You know, I have such a wonderful husband that, you know, we're pure equals. And so what that means is if I'm not there to do something, he picks up the slack and vice versa. And he very much did that. I think I felt so confident that he could, and I was a great mom, don't get me wrong. I still spent a tremendous amount of time with my sons, but there was also a tremendous amount of time always running off to the next disaster to save my brother for a 6-year span. I mean, this was a very, very long time. And so it did impact them. And what I sadly see now is the kids at the time, you don't think, I was that child, wasn't I?
Yeah.
And I never thought of all the horrible things my children were witnessing, and I think so much worse than what I ever saw as a child. And so all I can do is apologize for that and wish I had done things different and try and encourage other people to do things differently, because I should have set that healthy boundary with my brother very, very early on.
There was an interaction that you described between you and a nurse. And once again, you were advocating on behalf of your brother. Talk about that, if you would.
Absolutely. That's the introduction to my whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, my brother, severely intoxicated, had been locked up again in a hotel room for, I think, 16 days of constant drinking. And then me and my mother rushed to save him. And, you know, at that point, alcoholics or any addict can't just stop. They can actually die from the effects of withdrawal. So they need medical attention. And when we went to the hospital, you know, my brother, you can visibly see and imagine, you know, what he looks like in this condition. And I could just, for the first time, I just felt what my brother always felt from other people. And that's just how someone, he disgusts them, and how he's judged, and it's stigmatized, and it's often not treated as an illness in the hospital. And, you know, I ran after the nurse, it's the nurse that had done that, you know, was taking his blood pressure and taking his blood, and I just chased her down, and I yelled at her, and I just said, that's somebody's son, that's somebody's brother, somebody loves them. And I get that you think this is self-induced, but he is sick. And, you know, that's the job that they chose. And so I couldn't handle it that day. You know, I went back and I sat in the corner of the room, and I just thought to myself, and oh, trust me, I explained so many scenes like this during our journey, and all I thought was, you know, my brother is in there. The real Brett is in there. And I just wanted to remind somebody of that day. And she came back in, and she was so kind to him. And, you know, I whispered thank you when we left, and I really meant it.
You mentioned and talk certainly in your book about the multiple suicide attempts by your brother. So not only is there the terror, the growing terror about the level of his alcoholism, but then the additional worry about his ability to attempt to take his life.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I think that very much, and I think, you know, it does serve maybe right now to explain to all your listeners that, you know, sadly my brother did lose his battle with addiction in March of 2012. And that is very understandably why people react in a certain way. You're trying to keep them alive. And my brother never had suicide attempts when he was sober. I mean, always just the complete sadness and being despondent and all those feelings when he was drinking, but he just couldn't ever stop drinking. But that's the one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle, that, you know, this his journey was from 2000 until 2012, And we do know so much more now. And at the time, he was always only getting treatment to stop drinking. I think he needed to be somewhere where they dealt with his mental health issues and his trauma from childhood and some of these things that he felt deep inside. And I just don't think that's where the world was at necessarily in 2006. But it is where we're at today. And so I'm very happy to advocate on behalf of that, that you need to get help for the mental health issues and the addiction at the same time.
And detox is not sufficient.
No. I mean, all detox does is get the alcohol out of your system. But the underlying reasons why you're drinking to begin with, we missed all that. I know now. I remember he had night terrors when he was like 5 and 6 years old. He sleptwalked. He had the most severe headaches when we were little children. I see now that that was some of the trauma. And, you know, it wouldn't be a reasonable expectation to think in the 1970s my mom would have got him help for that.
Right.
But today, you can. Today we're educated and we know. And so some of those signs show up very early, but you have to be brave enough to be looking for them and to acknowledge actually why maybe a child is struggling.
And
I mean, if you're denying all this stuff is going on, you're not going to get your child help, are you?
Not at all. And it's I don't want to use the word easy, but it's, let me put it this way. It's really difficult to imagine that your child, your brother, your son, your daughter is having a problem with alcohol or depression. I mean, that's really hard for many people to sort of grasp. And then there's so much self-blame for what's going on with the loved one.
Oh, and I love that you threw the word blame in there, because I think that is the most destructive word we have. This isn't about blame. Like, if we don't talk about this and acknowledge it's going on, then how are we ever going to get help for any of our loved ones? I discuss all this, and I don't blame my parents. They made some mistakes. I made some mistakes. I've mentioned them. But I think we all need to remove that word of blame and instead come together and be strong and just admit some of these things. And then we can all move on. We can forgive and we can get help. I just think that's a beautiful thing.
There was a time when you wrote a letter about your brother and you were asking for help for your brother. To whom did you write the letter?
Yeah, well, it was probably about 4 or 5 years into his severe addiction, and he was finally, I thought, oh my God, he's finally getting the help he needs. Like, this is it. And he was going into the hospital for a 5-day assessment, and my mom asked me to write a letter to the psychiatrist and say everything that's been going on. And so I hated writing it. I mean, the changes in my brother, of, you know, he was hiring prostitutes and watching porn and spending money he didn't have, and he was drinking himself in and out of consciousness, about 40 ounces of alcohol a day. And
oh,
I wanted them to know that bipolar and depression ran in our family, and just, it was the hardest letter I've ever wrote, but somebody had to do something. And, you know, my mom picked him up from the hospital 5 days later and they came to get me. And when I jumped into the car, my brother was reading that letter. And to this very day, I have no idea if she ever even gave it to the physician. I just know Brett looked up and just stared right into my eyes. He didn't say anything, but I knew I'd broken his heart.
You know, what's interesting is that your mother asked you to write the letter. Another example of you taking care of your brother.
And I think probably it shows too why, you know, as our story goes on, how hard it was when I finally had to say no to my family and them just not understanding. You know, I'd never said no for almost 40 years. And it's not that I didn't, I couldn't say no. I didn't know. I didn't know that was an option. I didn't know it was an option to, yeah. I didn't know it was an option to say no to my family.
Which is the case, I think, for so many people who are brought up to be the caretakers. I mean, you were essentially taking care of your siblings, but you're also taking care of your parents. Certainly you were taking care of your mom.
For sure. There's no doubt. And so, you know, through this, I gathered strength and understanding, and I, you know, read books and went to therapy myself. And, you know, no one was changing in our story, no one. And so it stayed exactly the same. But for my brother, it would get worse because, of course, alcoholism is progressive, and so it gets worse with time. And I just finally thought, okay, somebody or something has to change. And so I was the one that took that step.
Another piece, that's interesting is that somewhere along your path, your birth father was angry that you were having a relationship with your mom. And sort of in a drunken rage, you know, he told you about an older sister, which you figured was just part of being drunk, but it wasn't actually.
I know. Even myself writing it and having to remember all these things that happened, I'm like, people would think this is fiction. but I think that's what happens in dysfunctional families with chaos. And, you know, I thought at first it was just a story of alcoholism. But my goodness, it certainly isn't. We had a very unhealthy family. And yeah, my dad did, until I put a stop to it, have a habit of phoning me intoxicated on so many occasions. It always bothered me. And he was mad one evening, and he just blurts out, you know, if your mom is so gosh darn perfect, Jody, where the hell is your older sister? And, you know, I just thought, I mean, you know, he's crazy and drunk, and I hung up the phone. And, you know, I told my mom about the conversation a few days later, and her reaction just told the story. It was just like, oh my goodness, it's true. And yeah, my mom and dad, my mom got pregnant by my father at 15, and they gave the baby up for adoption. So yeah, I have an older sister out there. And so, you know, it didn't take me long to get a hold of the adoption agency and make that connection. And so, yeah, we found her.
It's extraordinary that you found her. But again, what one of the streams I think that underlies our conversation today is the damage that secrets can do in relationships and in families.
I wrote the story, I don't say that until the very end. When you hear that someone has taken their own life, I think most people, that's all they think of. And, of course, the guilt comes in, you know, and the self, you hear the things, oh, they're selfish and all these things. That's one of the most important reasons why I wrote this book. I wanted people to see the whole story, to feel for the little children that grew into adults. But also, most importantly, I wanted people to understand my brother died of alcoholism, not of suicide. And had he gotten the help he needed and dealt with his mental health issues and stayed sober and went to meetings and did all the things he needed to do, there is nothing I am more sure of than my brother would be here today. And I didn't want people to lose sight of that, so I didn't tell them that at the very beginning.
Sure.
And it just, to me, just is such a celebratory thing to all the people that are in recovery. 23 million, I think, in the U.S. and 5 million in Canada. But it is not easy. And I also think everyone needs to change, not just the one that's addicted.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, the notion that people who are using any sort of substance or doing anything in excess, it's not being done just to be done. It is an attempt to self-medicate. It is an attempt to deal with, as you've said repeatedly, their own trauma and their own pain.
Yes, it's not just, okay, stop drinking, or you have no willpower, stop drinking. You have to get to the bottom of why they're doing that to begin with. And as long as we're hiding with secrets and shame in our family, they're not going to get the help they need. My own family, I'll rephrase that, not my own family, a couple members of my own family warned me not to dare tell this story. And I'm sorry, but I'm not ashamed of it. I am proud to have been my brother's sister. And I think I can't change anything that happened, can I? But I can make it a beautiful lesson for some other family that's going through the same thing. And if that makes them change and saves the life of someone they love, that fills the gaping hole left in my heart.
When you say a couple of members of your family warned you not to tell the story, what was the warning? What were they concerned about?
One, you don't talk about this.
Okay.
And you don't, you know, that's their, you don't talk about what goes on in families. And I think they look at it like it's a negative. I will say my own mother, it'll ruin his reputation. How dare I say these things? Why would the progression of alcoholism ruin somebody's reputation? That's just not a belief that I have. And if somebody does have that belief, I think that shows they're a little bit more about who they are, not who I am.
Absolutely.
If I wrote a story about my brother or my grandfather that had died of cancer and the progression of cancer, there's some uncomfortable things you're going to read about. But no one would ever challenge me on that, would they?
Not at all.
And so that's what I think we need to change. And I'm very proud of my story. And I'm even prouder to say my brother knew I was writing it and encouraged me. And he was in denial. He thought he was getting well. I knew my brother was going to die, and that I had known it for a long time.
That's a hard thing to know.
It is. It is, and knowing you can't stop it. It's that's where your head and your heart get confused, don't they? Because I couldn't stop it. That wasn't my responsibility. Only he could do that.
At the point that you were able to set those healthy limits, did the quality of your marriage and your family life change?
Oh, gosh, it did. Because finally I could concentrate on my own family and I could get out of bed. And I think that healthy boundary also, it literally saved my life as well, because I still thought of, I only saw my brother maybe four times in the last 5 years of his life because he couldn't stay sober. And so it wasn't very often. But I think it made when he passed away a little bit easier for me because it just made it bearable. At the time, I didn't think I'd survive if anything happened to him. And I am responsible for my own children and my own marriage. And you're allowed to have your own life. And you shouldn't feel bad for that ever. You are entitled to that. I mean, some people have to get a divorce and all sorts of things, that the choices that we all have to make. It's very painful.
It sounds like one of the limits you set was with your brother, not willing to engage with him unless he was sober.
Yeah. absolutely. And then I told him that I, you know, he had been to rehab 6 or 7 times and it wasn't getting better. And it just took over my whole life. And it's what he needed as well. And I think he needed that from other family members, the taking away the enabling factor, and for him to stand up on his own 2 feet, and for him to actually see how bad it really was. And all of that would have been done out of love, nothing but love. I think if that had been done early on, it perhaps would have made a difference.
One of the things that I hear, though, is the modeling for your children that you don't have to accept bad behavior and you don't have to take ownership for the behavior of someone, even if you care about them, that is not your job.
Yeah, and I very much, you know, and even I raised 2 sons now that are adults. They're 24 and 26 years old. And even I know for them, I have talked openly and honestly. I've talked about what runs in our family. I have talked about why I view alcohol in a certain way, and that they always should be so aware, you know, especially because there is a heredity component. But I even know with my own sons, you know, the choices they make with the tools and the education I gave them, that's on them. That is not on me. So that's a powerful lesson. I even took away from my own story. You know, instead of just believing you're just responsible for these people that you love.
You say that even as of the writing of your book, at the time that you actually wrote The Sun Is Gone, your mother and your sister Nicole were still saying that you did not do enough for your brother. Am I understanding that correctly? Is that what they said?
Well, that's what they said, even from that. And I think that happens in a lot of families. You see the fighting, and people don't want to admit someone is an addict in the family. And so they start to shift the blame, and then the fighting starts amongst them. And I don't think we're unique in that way. But yeah, when I set that boundary, and to this day, my mother and I are still estranged, and we will be forever, that I abandoned my family and I deserted my brother. And, you know, I know enough now to know just because my mother says it does not make it true. But I want to say it's never too late to forgive. I had been estranged from my sister for 8 years, and she read the book, and she contacted me and said it was the most beautiful thing she's ever read, and that she never saw any of it through my eyes. And I think that's the message for people, that we can, you know, forgive and have hope and love and healing, and that we all are imperfect and make mistakes.
What an extraordinary conversation between you and your sister after she read the book.
Alcoholism has destroyed many relationships in all of my family, sadly. And I never, ever thought I would get my sister back. And so it's been about 6 months. And even for her to understand now how our sister-sister dynamic changed when she was 15 and I was 21. And it's a beautiful thing. You know, we're going slow, but we're talking about our childhood now for the first time in our whole life. And we're just trying to be sisters. I'm not trying to be her mom. That's not the person. I just want to be sisters.
You spent so much of your formative years being the mom. Is it hard now to not engage in that role with your children are adults, you're their mom, but in a different way. But is it hard not to do that with other family and friends?
Yeah, we have addiction in our family tree. So every once in a while, people do still come to me for, you know, to money or bail me out of this or, and I do always say no. And I always remind them I'm saying no out of love. The hard part still about all that is they don't understand sometimes, and so they get angry, and I accept that because I'm not moving back in life. I'm moving forward. But it is hard to break those patterns. You have to be very aware of them. You know, I'll tell you, I was at the therapist about 10 months ago, and the therapist actually said to me, you know, you couldn't save your brother, Jody, and so you wrote a book, and now maybe you want to save the world. And I said, oh, no, you got this all wrong. I'm not that girl anymore, but I'm not going to stop being a good person. And so I wrote this book. Yes, I hope it helps other people. And I did it in a healthy way. I didn't do it to save everyone in the world. And so I think you can find that healthy balance of being supportive to others, but knowing when not to.
Knowing when not to is such a challenge. And, you know, I think about the numbers of people. I think about the numbers of people who get that call in the middle of the day or the middle of the night. And it's, you know, bail me out of jail, or I need a lawyer, or, you know, mm-hmm. pick me up at this place. And it's so hard. I mean, really hard to say, I'm not going to do that.
Oh, it is a pain like no other, but it is the right thing to do. They have to do this on their own. And we're all told, all of our stories are different, but what we are all told, every single one of us, is if our loved one doesn't stop doing drugs or alcohol, they will die. And that is what I think you need to use for your motivation. That is the reason why you don't give money and pay rent and bail them out and do all those things. They just don't have motivation to change, and it just allows this to progress. And I really believe that. And, you know, what I like to share, I hear from a lot of families who also have lost a loved one. And if there's one gift I can give them, it's, if you're not everyone makes it, but not everyone survives cancer either. And do not ever feel guilty. Don't carry that with you. And don't carry anger and blame and all those negative feelings. I just feel so much better when I can talk about this story and just think that it could help somebody else.
Absolutely. You say we are not promised that it is easy. We are promised that it is possible.
Yep, and we're not. Change is scary, and change is hard, and that is not just about addiction. That is about anything we're going through in life. But change takes changing. And I think that's the answer.
For those listening, what would you say is a first and second step to take if they have a loved one who is dealing with this kind of challenge?
I think the most important part, and it is what I would do first, I would get help for myself first, the very first thing. We're so concentrated on the person that is sick that we don't see we need help. So get help for yourself first by someone that specializes in alcohol, drug addiction, or mental illness, or whatever you're going through. And then get help for your loved one as well. And listen to the advice of the professionals. Do exactly what they say, even if that's not what your heart is telling you to do.
And that can be the hardest part.
That is the hardest part. It is, but you have to know that you're doing it out of love.
Jody Prowse, author of The Son Is Gone, A Sister Lost in Secrets, Shame, and Addiction, and How I Broke Free. Jody, is there a website folks can go to?
Absolutely. They can get it on Amazon or my website, which is jodeprouse.com, JodeProuse.com.
Terrific. Jody, thank you again for this book and for the compassion and the bravery with which you approached this very personal, very important topic.
Thank you so much. And I am just wishing love and happiness and courage to all your listeners.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is available to you on demand by going to mynd.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. I would love to hear from you, so if you have any questions or comments that you would like to share about this or any conversation you hear on Mind Talk, my email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That is mynd.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.